Welcome to another episode of UBC Arts on Air, a program of profiles, perspectives, and pertinent discussions with UBC Arts faculty, students, and program directors. And today, I'm joined by Professor Max Cameron from the Department of Political Science and the director of the UBC Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions. Welcome, Max.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Let's start with the center. I love the name, Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions. What is it, and how did it get started?
Well, it started about 10 years ago, and the idea is to encourage publicly engaged research, by which I mean we're interested in using the center to reach out to people in the larger public, in the community that we serve, and get a sense of what kinds of things they care about, what interests them, what sort of research can we do in the university that might be of value to them, and then to encourage that kind of research so that we produce knowledge that's of use to and of interest to the larger public and to the larger community that we serve.
It sounds wonderful and theoretical, but if I'm an undergraduate majoring in political science, do I have an opportunity to participate in any of the programs, or is this a graduate center?
We certainly involve graduate students very closely in a lot of our research, and so they are engaged with us. But we've also brought undergraduates in to help do some of the work that we're doing when we organize conferences and events and that sort of thing. But I think more broadly, some of the programming that we're looking at, I hope, will be of great interest to undergraduates. One example is we have a proposal to develop a model parliament. We're working very closely with Preston Manning on this idea. The idea is to prepare people for public life. You know, if you want to, you know, be a barista at Starbucks, you have to have 30 hours of training, as Preston likes to say. To be a member of parliament, all you have to do is throw your name in the hat and run and get elected. And, you know, politicians run big, expensive enterprises. You know, the federal government, the provincial government, these are big operations, and it's important that you have qualified people. So we're going to create a model parliament, which isn't a model parliament in the conventional sense, the sort of high school replica of our federal or provincial parliaments, but rather it's a training ground where people who have political aspirations will get mentoring and hands-on intensive training from practitioners, as well as research support from academics, so that they get a sense of what it actually means to be a legislator, with the hope then that some of these people will in fact run for office and that we can improve the quality of the people who are involved in public life in this country.
So actually you raise a fascinating point, because in fact I don't believe there's any training, is there, to become a politician, and certainly not a member of government?
There isn't, absolutely none. I mean, all of the parties have their own campaign training courses. So, for example, they'll show you, they'll teach you how to become a candidate, how to run for office. And once you get elected, there are often brief seminars that are offered by the legislatures to sort of show you where the washrooms are and how to collect your pension and things like this. But what we don't have, and we've actually done a whole survey of comparable programs around the world, there's absolutely nothing like this anywhere in the world. We don't have, in any of the countries that we've looked at, programs that are designed to help aspiring politicians do the work of being legislators. And in a recent report that was done by Samara, by the Samara organization, they found, after surveying many former politicians, former parliamentarians, they asked them to describe the sorts of things that they do. You know, they advocate for causes, for regions, they help individual constituents, they have pet projects. Some of them might occasionally submit a private member's bill, but very few of them actually define their roles as legislators as being central to what they're doing. And we think that that really is the critical thing that our parliamentarians should be doing, is making laws. And so we're going to design a program that provides training for would-be legislators so that they can look at issues like everything from knowing your constituents to running a small office to making a bill, to what is representation, to dealing with the media and interest groups.
I find it startling, actually, that there is no program, no training, you know, that you, potential member of a parliament federally or, you know, provincially, that you don't have to take. That, I mean, other than the two-day orientation,
right,
you're pretty much on your own.
Yes, and of course, what people are learning in these campaign schools and in these orientations isn't necessarily what we think that they need to learn. We conducted a focus group where we brought together in an online 3-day discussion 18 sort of aspiring people who were interested in running for public office and talked with them about the kinds of things that they think that they would need to learn in order to be effective in political life. And of course, what people may think they want to learn and what the parties think that they need to learn may be different from what we think they need to learn. In other words, we're not about encouraging people to replicate the folly that we see in the existing legislature. We're not going to provide image management consulting. This isn't a finishing school for people to do what the existing legislature is doing. What we want to do is take a hard look at how our political system works. What are some of the dysfunctions with it? What are some of the problems with it? I think for the most part we have institutions in Canada that work relatively well, but they could work a lot better. And so we see this also as a space for experimentation. It's a place where we can recruit people who have political aspirations and bring them together, give them some really solid practical training, but also encourage some reflection about how our political system could work differently.
It sounds marvelous. Now, earlier you mentioned you had been looking at countries around the world in terms of, finding some other models. And I want to switch to a particular country that I know you have a very strong interest in, and that is Peru. How did that come about, and your focus on Latin America as a professional, academic and even non-academic area of interest? What's the background?
Well, it's funny. I became interested in Latin America at a very young age. I grew up in a small provincial city, Fredericton, New Brunswick, very much a loyalist town, very conservative, dyed-in-the-wool sort of Tory place. But it also was a place that provided a home for refugees from South America, from Argentina, from Chile. This was in the 1970s. And people, academics, really fleeing from these countries where people were being tortured and disappeared, very oppressive and repressive environments, wound up coming to places like Fredericton and teaching. And I got to know and went to school with their kids. And I just fell in love with the culture and just thought that it was so fascinating to hear their stories about the region that I decided as soon as I graduated from high school, I'd spend the year traveling around the region. And so I spent a year. I was in El Salvador shortly before Archbishop Romero was killed. I was in Nicaragua just after the revolution occurred and actually was involved in doing some volunteer work with a coffee cooperative. Traveled south down through Peru under the military generals just as they were about to leave office and was in the southern cone under the dictatorship in Argentina and Chile. And then after that, came back and decided to study at UBC, went into the Arts One program, wanted to kind of, I had fallen in love with Latin America, but I felt that I needed to understand it better and that for that I needed a kind of a good liberal arts education, then ultimately wanted to become a social scientist because studying at UBC, I began to read the work of people like Guillermo O'Donnell, who had written a fantastic book on called Modernization and Bureaucratic Authoritarianism, which explained the rise of these authoritarian regimes. And then, of course, he was involved in debates about the transitions to democracy and wrote about how those processes began and how they were engineered. And I thought nothing could be more magnificent than to be involved in those kinds of conversations. And so I went to graduate school at Berkeley, and it was suggested to me by my supervisor, in fact, David Collier, that I write my dissertation on Peru, which is where I met my wife. And so my first book was on Peru. And my wife is from Peru, and so I spent a lot of time there. It's an amazing place.
You make it sound coherent and cohesive, as though there was a plan, but it was an experience, wasn't it, that kind of led you to a series of other moments that then seem, if I could use the word in retrospect, to have this continuity to it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that Latin America just has always been a place that has fascinated me. It's colorful. But it's also because the region provides so many great examples of the kinds of things that interest me intellectually as well. So it's a kind of a living laboratory, as it's often been described, for anyone who's interested in problems of democratization, authoritarianism, human rights. Latin America is, the history is just so rich and interesting that even there are times I think when I become depressed about the trends in the region and I try to avert my gaze to other places, but I'm always called back to it just because it is so interesting and it offers such extraordinary material to work with for a political scientist.
And today, is contemporary Peru going through a transition, or do you feel that it's reached a certain moment in its history where things are stabilized?
Yeah, I've seen this country go from what was a kind of a living hell in the 1980s. I mean, honestly, it had hyperinflation on par with Weimar Germany. It had a civil war as nasty as anything anywhere. 70,000 people were killed. Massive human rights violations, collapse of democracy, and of course, the economy tanked. And people just went through a miserable, miserable time. Today, the economy is booming. It's gone through 10 years of just the most extraordinary economic growth. And that has, in fact, trickled down, not everywhere, not so much into the highlands and into some of the poorer areas, particularly where the indigenous populations are most heavily concentrated. But in the coasts, in the major cities, there has been such an expansion of the economy that it has really transformed the country. And the country is now beginning to think of itself as a middle-class place. And, of course, the politics have changed as well. Fujimori was ultimately fled Peru, came back and put on trial. He's now in jail. He was the autocratic ruler who governed the country between 1990 and 2000. Today there is an elected government. This is the third election since 2000, and the government of Ollantumala is running a fairly tight ship. So it has been an extraordinary change, really.
Well, in your description of both the research and your personal life in terms of the connection with Latin America, you make political science seem as something very practical and pragmatic. But I was always led to believe political science is terribly academic.
Yes.
So comment, please, on the kind of political science today.
Yeah.
Is there still a kind of divide between the pragmatic and the academic?
Right.
Or do you find that yourself and colleagues are striving to somehow unite the two?
Yeah, it's interesting because political science isn't one of those fields in which we prepare people for practice, right? It is not the case that if you have a degree in political science, you are qualified to be a successful politician. And of course, we all can think of many, many examples of political scientists who have entered politics and been spectacularly unsuccessful. So there's no reason to believe that being steeped in the knowledge of the field of political science, you're necessarily going to be a good practitioner. And in fact, to become a good politician requires years of experience and extensive practice. It's the sort of thing that you learn by doing. And it's different from the kind of theoretical knowledge that is typically generated by political science. That said, many of us in the field of political science are drawn to the field because we love politics, because we're fascinated, because we think that politics and citizenship are noble activities, and that getting them right is critical for almost anything that we do. So there is a love of politics that I think animates us. But the challenge that sometimes I think we face in our discipline is the incentives that we operate on as political scientists to publish in top-tier journals, to be widely cited, to do research that's at the cutting edge of knowledge, which sometimes leads us into debates where we are more attuned to what other political scientists are saying than to what the larger public is thinking or what others may be thinking about politics. We need to sometimes swim a little bit against that current, and part of the goal of the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions is to say, well, let's take a question like, why don't more people go into politics, right? This is a question that, the public cares about. And if you talk to people who are actively involved in politics, they care about that sort of question. It's a little bit difficult to get a handle on it from the perspective of the kind of work that gets done in mainstream political science departments. And yet, asking those questions, I think, actually is healthy for us as political scientists, because it reminds us of the need to remain connected to the practice of politics and to think about what kinds of skill and disposition somebody needs to be successful in politics, and then to think, well, are there things that we could be doing in the university that would contribute to that? Does the university, in fact, have a role in doing what I mentioned before, which is the public engaged research, but also preparing people for public life? I don't think that we can train people. I can't say that if you study political science, you're going to learn how to be a good politician. Is provide connections between great leaders, for example, and our students, because many of our students have a clear and generous vocation to go into public life. They're interested in politics. And I think that universities can play a role in harnessing that and directing it and perhaps encouraging it.
Now, have you yourself, I'm not going to ask you if you've ever wanted to run for office, but have you or would you feel comfortable as an advisor to a government somewhere, or have you done that?
Well, I don't see why you shouldn't ask me why or whether I've ever thought of running for office, because, you know, sometimes people are very coy about their political ambitions. Nobody wants to say,
yes,
I would like to
I
be
would like.
Yes, yes, that's right. the occasional person who sort of says, yes, I want to be the prime minister or something, we look upon as being a little bit deranged. Or in fact, even going into politics, when you say, oh, I'd like to go into politics, people look at you like, are you crazy? I was talking to a member of parliament recently who said when he got elected, he sat around the table with his extended family at Christmas, and one of his relatives said, so, you're now a politician, are you? And it's like that was a shameful thing. That was embarrassing that somebody had kind of gone into this, what's seen as really being a kind of a dirty profession. It's a despised profession. We actually really don't like our politicians. We feel that they're, I do something that, you know, Mike Harcourt started me doing this. He did this, and I do it from time to time at talks. You sort of say, I'm going to say a word. I'm going to yell it out. And you just say whatever comes to mind. What's just free associate. And I'll say, here's the word, politician. And people will yell out, you know, liar, thief, scumbag, terrible, terrible things, right? All of the associations we have with politics are really quite negative. And I think that's really unfortunate because, I'm an Aristotelian, and Aristotle thought politics was a noble activity. And that in a well-run polity, perhaps people would not want to enter into politics because, it really is looking after the affairs of others. And it says something very sad about the state of our affairs when we look at politicians as being, they're in it for themselves. They don't really care about you. They don't really care about me. They're in it to advance their own careers. And, I think that's something that we have to sort of fight against. So, but to answer you did ask.
Yes, I want to ask
question.
You now. I mean, so I did, are you planning any political moves?
No, I have no political aspirations, in part because I think I made a decision to live an academic life and to contribute to, I think people hear callings. People have, if you go into politics, it's because you're called to. You hear the call, politics calls you, and you respond to that. Just as if you're religious, you hear religious calling, or you hear the call of business if you're an entrepreneur. And I think people are called. And I've heard that calling faintly in the past. And I actually did help a candidate run for the leadership of a political party. It was Sven Robinson of the NDP back in 1993. And if Sven had been chosen the leader, I most certainly would have entered. In fact, I remember the first time I met Sven, I said, when I listen to you, something in what you say touches a chord in me as a social democrat. And he said, oh, so you want to be a member of parliament, do you? And it sort of shocked me because that was actually not what I was thinking. I was thinking, I'd like to help and support you. Tell me how I can do that. But he picked up that there was a political ambition there too. But when Sven lost, I went back to my research and writing, and I think I'm at a stage in my career where I know I've made a contribution to ideas that's a modest one. If I were to try to go into politics at this stage, I would abandon that and lose the opportunity to make a larger contribution to ideas and probably wouldn't be a very successful politician. And so for me, the value of studying political science is that you can contribute to the kinds of ideas that I think do shape our politics. If we think about the big questions of political life, why does somebody enter politics? What do we do together in politics? When should we obey or disobey authority? What's the role of the state? What should it play in terms of promoting prosperity, what how big should the state be, what kind of influence should it have in the decisions we make, how do we create the freest, the most egalitarian societies that are possible. Those questions and those issues are shaped by thinkers like Hobbes and Locke and Rousseau and Montesquieu in an earlier generation, today by people like Charles Taylor or Jürgen Habermas or Guillermo O'Donnell. And I want to be part of that conversation. I want to be part of the discussion around the issues of what is democracy, what does it mean, how can we make it work better? Because I think that in the long run, that's where an academic can have a positive impact.
Now, I understand this coming year you're going down to Peru again in mm-hmm. January. What are you going to be doing there?
Well, I have a sabbatical coming up, so I will be finishing a book that I started, which is on the topic of practical wisdom, that comes out of a series of seminars or colloquium series that I ran last year through the Peter Wald Institute when I had a brief gig there as a scholar in residence. And that led to, I think, a book that I'd like to complete. But then starting in January, I submitted a proposal as part of the larger UBC proposal to the Canadian International Development Agency on the topic of governance of extractive industries. And the specific proposal was to create a observatory of the governance of extractive industries in Latin America. So what we'll be doing is creating research teams that will be tracking where the big mining, oil, and gas industries are operating, what the challenges they face are there in terms of the environment, in terms of dealing with local communities, in terms of complying with local regulations, and so forth. And we'll be looking from the perspective of the industry, of governments, and of the affected communities, and trying to get a sense of what are the best practices that result in successful processes of development and extraction that can alleviate poverty, that mitigate environmental impacts, and that are done in such a way as to reinforce citizenship and democracy, as opposed to blow up in confrontations where people get shot and the environment is destroyed or mining companies are unable to even undertake the investments they want to undertake because the projects are so controversial. We see that wide range of outcomes throughout the region, and the goal of this observatory will be to look at those outcomes so that we can try to identify what are some of the best practices and what are some of the ways in which this can be done well.
Do you anticipate any opposition to that kind of research?
I do. It'll be controversial. It almost is by definition. There are interests at stake, right? Big companies are interested in extraction. Governments are often caught in between. On the one hand, the powerful industry lobbies, but also the pressures from communities that don't want these processes to go ahead. And then, of course, there are the local affected communities. So by definition, these are contentious issues. But I think, you know, we recently had John Ruggie here, who gave a talk at the Vancouver Institute and as part of the Mark Zacher Distinguishing Lecture Series. He has developed a set of what he calls guiding principles for human rights and international corporations. And what those principles lay out are ways of thinking about from the perspective of a company, what are the kind of risks and costs associated with extractive industries? From the perspective of governments, the issues of accountability and responsiveness, and from the perspective of citizens, harm and repair. And what we have to try to do is bring these different perspectives together and see whether there's a possibility of dialogue. So really, it's of course it's controversial, but at the end of the day, the way that you can address these controversies is by trying to provide a forum and a framework for dialogue where you find whether there is a way forward that can attend to all of the demands that are brought to the table by the different parties.
Pretty fascinating. Now, I know we're kind of approaching the end of our time here, but I have to ask you about your blog.
Oh, yeah.
How effective do you think that blog is, and why are you writing it?
Well, I've had a couple of experiences with blogs. In 2006, I started this blog on the Peru election. And it was an experiment. I'd read about blogs, and this was around the time that they were becoming popular. And I thought to myself, well, you know, one of the problems with being an academic is that, you know, I'm going to go to Peru. I'm going to be there during the elections. I'll write an article or two afterwards. I'll send it to a journal. It'll be reviewed for a minimum of 4 months, could be 8, could be 12. And then if it's approved, then it's another year until the thing comes out. By that point, everybody's lost interest in, or, you know, we're 2 years past the election. Wouldn't it be nice if during the course of research, the observations that we make could just be simply made available and publicly and for free. And so we everything that we did, I followed candidates on the hustings. I went around every time I heard about a campaign event. I would go and I would participate and I'd watch and I'd talk to people and interview and so forth. I just posted everything on the blog. And what was great about it was that we could also see why people were coming to the blog. So we would check the search terms people used to reach our blog. And for example, one of the terms that kept coming up over and over again was Ollantumala. People wanted to know about this candidate who back in sort of around October of 2005 really was not well known, but our readers knew about him enough to ask questions, and then we saw a few pundits picked up the story. So we thought, well, look, if this is something that's about to happen, let's get on top of it. So we followed this candidate very closely, and of course he almost won the election in 2006 and then did win in 2011. And so, in fact, we learned from our readers what to pay attention to. And I think that's the real advantage of blogging, is the interactiveness with your readership means that you can they actually influence the research that you're doing. They help direct your attention to the things that the public is interested in. And I think that's the sort of thing that is interesting to do as an academic, because, you know, if you just do the normal peer review route, you just won't get that kind of guidance from your readers.
Well, that's a wonderful explanation of it, because I've had questions myself about, you know, why blog? And too many blogs just seem to be very self-indulgent. And,
oh, my goodness,
and,
yes.
You know, I mean,
oh, yeah.
So why would you bother?
Right.
But you're giving a very interesting perspective on it,
yeah.
Which is, in a way, an outside perspective on the actual content of the blog itself.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think that's fascinating. And I think what you say about the immediacy is critical, because we all know the other story, right?
Right.
And
right.
14, 16, 18 months after you finished your
somewhat
contemporary essay or critique or whatever it happens to be, time has passed and events have passed.
Right.
So
right.
Really quite fascinating. Do other colleagues keep blogs in political science? Do you know?
A few of them do, and some of them have very lively blogs. And people use it for a wide range of purposes. So for some people, it's really about communicating with peers and colleagues who are interested in what may be fairly arcane matters for the general public. For others, it's a platform for reaching beyond the university into a wider public. I think you're right. Sometimes it's pretty self-indulgent, but oftentimes it's a vehicle for just bringing people together who have a common interest. And I'll confess even that last week I tweeted for the very first time. I'm not sure that I'm going to go there, but I did try it, and it was kind of interesting.
Did you get a response?
I did. I tweeted somebody, a former student of mine who's now working for Al Jazeera, and I congratulated him on how quickly he had got off of a plane from Doha in Venezuela and written really quite a good feature essay on Venezuela. And I said to him, I was impressed how quickly he put it together. And he said, well, that's the nature of our business. We have to do things very quickly. And I realized as I was putting the finishing touches on a manuscript I started in 1996 that we were really living in very different worlds.
Well, 96 doesn't strike me as being that long
it's
ago.
A good year, yeah.
You said 1890s? No, 19. Anyway, on that timely note, it's my great pleasure to thank Professor Max Cameron, who's taken us from the world of tweets to extracting industries and many, many other things really around the world. It's really just fascinating. So thanks again, Max Cameron from the Department of Political Science, who's given us his thoughts on democracy, on choice and government. And tune in for future episodes of UBC Arts on Air. Upcoming, revising the curriculum, and believe it or not, returning to a Great Books program. Thank you again.
In fact, powered by the Canadian Undergraduate Technology Conference is a conference that brings together visionaries, leaders, and enthusiasts from all industries. The conference lets you personalize your own experience from a broad range of breakout sessions and unique workshops. conference will be held on May 4th at UBC. For more information, go to infect.cutc.ca/Vancouver.
This week on the Arts Report, film, theater, dance, books, visual art, and more. Every Wednesday at 5 p.m., the Arts Reporters explore what's fun, fascinating, campy, or critical in the Vancouver art scene. You can find bonus content on our Mixcloud, Facebook, and Twitter. Got an idea for a review, interview, or original production? Email arts@citr.ca. Listen Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or anytime on citr.ca.